Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Welcome to the show, everyone. This is Sublimely Gothic, Season 3, Episode 2. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today, we're talking about the one and only novel by Oscar Wilde, The Picture of Dorian Gray. Despite the editor deleting parts of the story without Wilde's knowledge, still the book shocked readers and many believe that Oscar Wilde should be prosecuted for violating laws that guarded public morality.
Man, what if... First of all, amazing writer. I wish he would have stuck, you know, been able to stay on this planet a little longer and write a couple more novels because this was so wonderful. But second of all, pretty tragic life from what I know of him.
Was he the one who died in a duel?
Maybe he did. I know he spent some time in jail. And I don't remember why he spent some time in jail, but he did not take to jail well, which I think that's kind of the reason for jail is not to have a good time. But I don't remember how he died. I'm going to look it up really quickly.
All I remember is like in some random like fashion documentary, I know that two of his sisters died in crinolage fires. Do you know what the crinoline was?
No. What is that?
So that was like the hoop that women would put underneath their pettiskirts to get that Victorian circular shape.
Yes.
So literally fire hazard with all the types of drapey clothes they wore, and depending on the material of that like hoop skirt, like their hoop skirts caught fire and they died.
That's absolutely horrible.
And then they mentioned, yeah, again, I just know this from a random fashion documentary. The only other thing I remember is that, you know, some people like got sick or died completely from arsenic poisoning because they would put arsenic in some of the dyes for the greens they wanted.
Oh my. We used to have a grand old time with different things like that. I remember the, it's the women that would paint the clock faces and they would dip their brush in like glowing ink, and then they would like lick the tip of the brush and it caused all kinds of, I think, death and cancer and things like that. So we're all, I guess we're horsing around with all kinds of things back in the day, but it looks like Oscar Wilde died of meningitis in November 30th, 1900. But apparently there are different opinions on why he had that. But anyway, he spent a bit of time in prison. So I'm not really sure why he went to prison. I want to say it was because of homosexual behavior, but that's something I'm quoting, but I'm not sure.
So. Yeah, because that would be, so he died 10 years after this was published. So it was first originally published in a sort of serial format, I believe, in 1890, and then it was published again in 1891.
Okay.
Yeah, but so, preliminary impressions, what did you think?
I think my biggest, first of all, when I realized this was described as a gothic and philosophical novel, I had read a bit of it before reading that, and I was like, oh, okay. So I am supposed to get some like philosophy from this because there are so many passages in here that are just, you know, you almost kind of want to put the book down and kind of think about it for a little bit. And I've highlighted this thing like crazy. So I'm sure I will continue to do that. But, you know, I talked to our friend and frequent podcast guest Morgan Chalifant, and he said he liked the idea but didn't really like how it was executed. I liked the idea, and I think I was so enamored with how he wrote, I don't care if, you know, how it's executed. I just thought the idea was great and the writing was fantastic. What was your takeaway from this?
I am surprised by how much I enjoy it. Again, I can't even say, like, there are just some books, famous classical books, that I will just innately shy away from, which is kind of odd because I'm not usually the snob that is just like, oh, because this is so popular, I reject it, you know? But for whatever reason, like Dorian Gray was in that category where I knew it existed and I knew obviously the basic plot of like the portrait and everything, but that didn't compel me really to want to pick it up. And it was likewise with Jane Eyre, and it's like, oh, everything's about Jane Eyre. But lo and behold, just exactly like Jane Eyre, I ended up adoring Picture of Dorian Gray as well.
I think I have had a little bit of that, like, it's popular, I'm going to turn my nose up at it. And this was kind of one that I'm like, I know I'm supposed to read this, like, and think it's great. And then I read it and I was like, this is pretty great. So, you know, I guess they're classics for a reason, right?
Yes, indeed. But first, before we delve in, shall we do our 60-second recap?
Yes, we're so into Harry Potter. Sometimes anyway, I have something to mention about that too. I forget about this part. So yeah,
let's do it. Yeah, the 60-second recap. Well, again, it's been a few weeks since we recorded our last Sublimely Gothic. It's been a break. This is our first time going in for the final season.
Yeah, final season. And I'm just going to do a little plug for the Rambling Raven Puffs podcast. So that's what we've also been working on. So check that out. If you like Harry Potter, we talk about the Gothic elements in Harry Potter too. So
yes, and even do tarot reading exercises.
I love that.
Alrighty then. So I'll go first. Again, it's been a few weeks since I read Picture of Dorian Gray. So let me count off in 3, 2, 1, go. So there's this really nice guy named Basil who has a model for a painting named Dorian Gray, his buddy. Dorian Gray ends up getting corrupted by Lord Henry, who has the most deplorable moral compass or lack thereof that I've ever seen in my life in literature. And then Dorian Gray ends up becoming like sort of libertine or whatever. He actually gets engaged and wants to marry this actress Sybil, but once she loses her acting, he's like, oh, like, you're not artistic, you're not beautiful anymore, screw you. She kills herself, and he goes on like 20 years like not aging, because the whole portrait that Basil did has absorbs all of his aging and all of his evil deeds. But he ends up going mad and going crazy, going back and forth like, should I be self-righteous or not? And then he tries to destroy the painting, but ends up just killing himself and being immortalized in the painting.
Wow, that was perfect. I'm not going to do that well. So, but I am. Do you want me to set my timer?
I can count you in 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay, so the beginning of we start with a gentleman who is having some beautiful young man sit for him named Dorian Gray. He has a buddy come and talk to him and talk about his hedonistic worldview and how beauty and sensual fulfillment are the only things in life worth mattering. He kind of gets into Dorian's head saying like, you're beautiful and that's kind of the only thing that matters. So at the time, Dorian kind of inadvertently transfers switches some roles with the painting. So he goes about his life. He meets a woman who's an actress. I don't know if they necessarily fall in love, but she falls in love with Prince Charming. And that goes a little sideways once she doesn't do a good job one night and his friends kind of rag on her. So
too late.
Damn, I got real caught up in that beginning. So
no, I will admit that's also my favorite part, the Sybil whole thing.
That was a very interesting kind of, you know, they're engaged, but they're not engaged. Like, what is the, I don't know. That was all pretty wild. And then the scene when they're in the attendance at the theater, these friends of his are like, this chick sucks. What are you doing? And he's like, oh, I guess she does. I just thought that was kind of sad.
Yeah, but we will get to that. First, again, we were joking about this in the Horrid episode. As you know, Horrid, a big theme is the haunted roses in that book. And then what does this book start off with?
Oh yeah, the oh my gosh, I'm trying to get to that page. I read this on my Kindle. Sorry. Let me see. Oh, I read it at the beginning of the at the beginning of the other podcast. The studio was filled with the rich odor of roses, and when the light summer wind stirred amidst the trees of the garden, there came through the open door the heavy scent of the lilac or the more delicate perfume of the pink flowering thorn.
Indeed, very poetic. And you know why Oscar Wilde is such a well-known writer, and why so many people like refer to him as like, oh, not everyone can be an Oscar Wilde.
I definitely, I understand why people love him so much after reading this.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, how the hell are Lord Henry and Basil even friends at this point?
I don't know, because Lord Henry kind of sucks. I mean, maybe this is the like type of person that, you knew like in college, and then it's just kind of like the person's just kind of still in your life, and you're like, yeah, I kind of don't really agree with him, but whatever. I don't know, because he is very, like, his philosophy on life is something else.
I don't know, because I dumped people like Lord Henry as early as my freshman year in college.
Smart woman.
Because, well, again, I think it's supposed to be a whole, the hypocrisy of polite society, if you will.
Just his attitude and kind of the artifice. Can you talk about that a little bit? I'm just curious.
Well, I'm just thinking, yeah, the idea of technically there is what society promotes in terms of good moral values and everything, but at the same time there's the patriarchal privilege where men can do whatever they want.
They are not kind to women in this at all. I highlighted so many things that just ragging on women and how ridiculous and stupid women are, how they're basically decoration and things like that. And I believe that's mainly out of Lord Henry's mouth, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm. And Dorian Gray's by extension.
Yeah. Yeah. Women have no appreciation of good looks, at least good women have not. What does it say? I'm bound to state that she has never told me he was good looking. Women have no appreciation of good looks, at least good women have not. So basically, good, decent women don't care what men look at, which is just total bullshit. I don't know.
It's interesting the picture of Dorian Gray, like its place in the whole Beauty and the Beast evolution within our psyche about that archetype of storytelling.
That's really interesting to talk about the Beauty and the Beast thing. I never made that connection with this story, but interesting.
Yeah, well, it's just the whole thing about, even in Disney's Hunchback of Notre Dame, who is the monster and who is the man?
Yeah.
And the idea that Dorian Gray is a shitty human being, but something else is absorbing all of the sort of bad elements of his personality and his soul, if you will, so that in terms of his physical appearance, he can hide all of it.
It's a little vampire-like.
It is like, very vampiric.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, again, it's never fully explained. We're just supposed to accept it as it is. I would have liked it maybe if like a devil or something, or like the Grim Reaper showed up and is like, oh, you wish for this? Okay, here's your cursed portrait.
I guess that was a little bit of criticism that I had. It's just all of a sudden, you know, he says this thing, he kind of flips out after Lord Henry talks about beauty and how he should like really, you know, once he loses that, he's kind of screwed. And then, you know, so he, in my opinion, flips out and kind of throws this like little fit. And then, you know, I don't know if it's a year later or sometime down the road, all of a sudden the portrait is reflecting his bad decisions, but it's never explained. I would have liked a little devil to be like, you know, said like, now all your sins will go into this painting.
Yeah, or like, or at least just like a little like FYI with like the Amazon Prime package.
yes, something like that.
Yeah, so I can understand that, but I think, again, the age old, be careful what you wish for. And so, yeah, I think, again, very philosophical novel. That is very true, to the point that, again, I think I've told you, you know, off mic, is my husband is a philosophy scholar, and so he very rarely, like, reads novels. Like, the only novels that can tempt him is some that are very, very directly, like, philosophical and analytical. And so when I told him, oh, I'm going to do Picture of Dorian Gray for my podcast, he's like, oh, yeah, Oscar Wilde, he's great.
Oh, good. Has he read this book?
I don't know if he's read all of it. He's read a little bit of it. And again, he just knows by its reputation that it's deeply philosophical. And so for that reason, he gives it more esteem than the majority of novels. Because again, usually he doesn't read literature. He just goes directly to the philosophy.
Well, this is a great, like, philosophy and novel kind of combo. So
And that's the only thing that my husband will touch if it's not directly Voltaire or Machiavelli or whoever.
That's awesome. I would be tired, even more tired than I already am, trying to fit all that into my life. So.
And I think it's supposed to be, I think it's an interesting comparison because I'm sure it's a plot device, you know, to have this sort of metaphor of beauty in the sense of art and beauty in the sense of society.
Beauty in the sense of art and beauty in the sense of society. So, can you talk about that a little bit? I'm just trying to...
Well, just the idea that, you know, it naturally it makes sense that we admire and, you know, are critical of and study the aesthetics of art. Mm. But when we try to apply that to actual society and, you know, trying to enforce these standards of beauty on actual people, then yes. that's really not very nice.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I'm just, like I said, I'm just digesting that, but there is an appreciation for, I'm laughing because behind me I have a print of Botticelli's The Birth of Venus. So like, even in myself, I love that kind of traditional, you know, female beauty, quote unquote beauty in art. But I think, you know, it's open for interpretation in life. But then there are too many thoughts swimming around in my head. All I can think about is the Kardashians for some reason, which I don't watch the Kardashians. Let's just chill on that. But some of the things that Lord Henry would say made me think of like that kind of aspect of society, which was very, very surface level.
Yeah. And one note I have here is the pursuit of pleasure. Can you defy social conventions without being an asshole? And so basically what I meant by that is, you know, there's a lot of literature and just general social commentary about, again, criticisms of individualism that, you know, you're selfish, you're only thinking about yourself, not thinking about the collective and everything. And so it's just the idea of, can you pursue your own happiness and defy what society expects of you without directly causing harm to, like, you know, your friends or, like, the people around you? Because the one thing I think about, like, I'm becoming more and more interested in the idea of, you know, trying to separate these sort of implications, you know, at a societal level and then in a personal relationship level. Like, for example, have you read Anna Karenina?
No, I have not. I did see the movie. But I haven't read it now.
So for me, it's like in terms of, you know, my personal judgment of Anna Karenina in what she does. Yeah, she's not very nice. She's very duplicitous and deceptive and not very repentant and, you know, all of those things. So at a personal level, I condemn her. But at a societal level, I feel bad for her because she is just doing exactly what the men did in this time. And yet she's treated like crap and gets so much more heat for it.
Yeah. You know, knowing what I know about that story, what is the other? Is Madame Bovary? Is that?
Madame Bovary. Yeah. Similar base. Very similar plot line.
Okay. Yeah. I think I may have read that. Who knows what I've read anymore because I can't even remember. But that's an excellent point because I think about it. You know, I think some people in my personal life have been critical of me because I have a tendency to put other, you know, other people before me to my own detriment. So, you know, it feels a little foreign. I think as women, we're raised to kind of do that. You know, everybody comes before you. Women, you know, serve people, you know, dinner to people before. I'm just thinking societally and historically, women's role has been very subservient. And so I wouldn't say that was necessarily thinking of, you know, your own pleasure first, but I don't think I have a good answer or a good thought about that, because you do want to, I think, again, we're still in the pandemic and we kind of see what the, you know, I'm going to do this because I don't really care what anybody thinks. And it's uncomfortable for me. The implications of that sometimes are deadly.
Yeah. And I think it's just the idea of there's a difference between, okay, I'm not going to get married, I'm not going to have children, and, you know, I'm going to have this bohemian lifestyle. I'm not going to have the mortgage with the white picket fence and all that. You can defy those societal expectations and still be a normal person. That's different from totally being like, I'm just going to be a philanderer and break everyone's heart and be totally disrespectful because everything, all of polite society is a social construct, and leave a whole bunch of broken hearts and other damage in my wake. There's a difference between those two. And I think Lord Henry is trying to inflate, you know, his selfish way of approaching life as, you know, I'm just, you know, doing what I want, because what's the point of being on this earth if not to do what you want?
I mean, like, that would be a really awesome thing to do if it had no other implications other than you just could do it whatever you wanted, and then, you know, then society would be fine. But that's just not the way it works. And I think that it makes me think of people, we just mentioned people in college that we've like said, you know, peace out from our social circle, that kind of act that way. I remember seeing people that kind of are experimenting with this idea in college, and just, it's like, it just makes you look like an asshole. It's not like, I think people think it's charismatic for maybe, you know, a couple days, and then they just think, or I mean, I personally was just like, dude, just get over yourself. Like,
I had to unfriend someone because they were spewing some crap about the cancellation of Dr. Seuss.
Oh, God.
Okay. And it's like, forgive me for going on a tangent here, but I think it's still within the scope of, you know, society, you know, pursuing your own pleasure versus whatever. And yeah, and certainly the, you know, the implications of you doing whatever you want in the context of a highly contagious virus is another matter entirely.
Right, exactly. I would agree with that very much.
But anyway, because one thing I'm thinking about is Lord Henry, and then, you know, Dorian Gray gets corrupted by him, is there a morality, an acceptance or rejection of society? Because society is hypocritical, where it has all these lofty societal ideas they put on this pedestal, but is anyone, especially white men in power, if they fall short of those, do they get punished, or do they get really any severe consequences for it? No. So is their pursuit of pleasure and their debauchery an acceptance or a rejection of their society, or both?
You're asking some tough questions. You like are really going in the philosophy route, which I love. It's great. So I'm thinking about Bridgerton, everyone.
I have yet to watch that yet. Is it any good?
It's very fluffy. And
is it guilty pleasure-esque?
It is very guilty pleasure-esque. I would just say to those listeners who have children or teenagers that they don't want to be very uncomfortable with, like, maybe just watch it by yourself. Because about episode 5, it turns into
orgy fest.
Yeah, there's a lot of I have said soft porn, but that whatever. Okay. A lot of people love it. So that aside, there is a storyline in there toward the end where, spoiler for Bridgerton, I guess I'm not going to name the characters, but the kind of the gentleman who has a higher place in society goes to the woman that he's been, you know, messing around with, and he wants to take her to this like dance. And she basically says, like, stop, you know, like, you can do this, you can mess around, but you're never going to marry me. So what's the point? What are you doing? You know, I have to do what's best for me in this society. And you need to realize that. And he kind of steps away and is like, you're right. That's exactly what I'm doing, is just kind of taking advantage of my best interest and not thinking about hers because he has the freedom to do that. And I think we see that with privileged people in our society a lot. You know, the golden parachute thing, a CEO can do something really, really stupid. And then they're just kind of, it's just kind of like a little, you know, oh, sorry, you lost your job, but enjoy your millions. So I don't know.
Yeah. So again, I kind of see it as both, because again, society is hypocritical, because even when it comes to, like, you know, our perceptions of women, it's a dichotomy. It's a Madonna whore complex. You know, society holds up, oh, chastity and purity and like meekness and goodness. But at the same time, society condemns women and justifying it that Eve tempted Adam and therefore all women suck and are duplicitous and whatever. And so, yeah, like this sort of amorality is an acceptance of the hypocrisy of their society, I should say.
Well, I'm going to throw another pop culture reference out. I just, the Britney Spears documentary, which
I have not seen it yet.
It's worth a watch just to, I'm Britney's age. So kind of growing up in this environment that she was being scrutinized under, where I thought this was just a really telling example of how women are treated in society. She was wearing, like, you know, skimpy clothes, dancing around, looking hot and whatever, and then always being asked if she was still a virgin. And it's like, what message are you sending to young girls? Like, this is, it's kind
of, they were
like
still asking that in the 90s.
Oh my God. It is, it's just horrifying to sit there and watch that. And I think this was even late 90s, early 2000s, that she's sitting in an interview with a female interviewer saying, like, you kind of shake your ass and do this, and are you still a virgin? I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, what are we doing here? So that's just I'm glad more attention is being given to this duality that women are expected to achieve, you know, the Madonna whore
as it suits a particular man at a particular time.
Exactly.
Yeah, not that hypersexualization and how certain female celebrities perpetuate that. Not that that's not an unworthy, you know, point of discussion. In fact, like, I'm starting to really, one of my more favorite Latina singers now is the Brazilian one, Anitta.
Oh, okay. I don't
really like her voice. I really like her. The only slight criticism I have of her is, again, she has such a good voice and is so talented. And sometimes I get a little uncomfortable with how much she relies on her sexuality.
Yeah.
Like, even more so than maybe some others, which, again, to me, like, in, you know, 2020 is saying a lot compared to what all, like, female celebrities are doing. But but that's just a personal, like, point of sociocultural commentary. I'm not here sitting like, oh, is she a virgin or not? Like, is she truly like this in her real life? And it's like, no, I don't care.
Right, right. It was really gross how much people cared about that. And it was a really, you know, growing up during that time, it was a really weird way to come up in, you know, looking at the way, basically watching that documentary made me remember what it was like being a teenager during that time and the messages young women were sent. And I think it was very confusing.
Yeah. But we digress. Dorian Gray. So ultimately, Dorian Gray is seduced into Lord Henry's debaucherous ways. And so they go about doing stupid stuff that would be typical of a white frat boy.
Yes.
But eventually, Dorian Gray stumbles upon the actress Sybil.
Right.
And he is so enamored of her, not just for being, like, quote unquote pretty, but purely her, like, acting ability. And he is enamored of her status as a quote unquote artist.
Yeah, this was a very interesting part of this story. And I know you said you liked it a lot as well, but the kind of discussions that about artists and art. And I highlighted something: good artists exist simply in what they make and are consequently are perfectly uninteresting in what they are. So that's why that's kind of an allusion to why when the friends go to see her perform and she's like not having a good night, they are just kind of like, what is the point of this relationship?
And, you know, it's interesting. You're just and in terms of artists, just reducing an artist to their works, that they're not a human being behind there's not a human being behind the art. Which I think the point of art is that, yeah, there has to be a human being, a soul behind it. Like, can a robot create art?
Right. I mean, and that's, you and I are both artists. So like some of this is kind of like, wait a minute. You know, I think about some of the, Marina Omnivar. I probably screwed up her name, but she does performance art. And it's like, you almost can't separate her from her work. But this is, when I read this, it again is from Lord Henry's mouth, and it's like, okay, well, we get it. You're just kind of a ruthless dick who thinks he's above everything.
Yeah. So again, I found the whole part with Sybil to be very interesting, because again, they have these questionable perceptions about art. And so Dorian is infatuated with her, and he's like, oh, we're engaged. I want you to meet my fiance. Come. You'll be so dumbfounded by how great she is at Romeo and Juliet. And so they go, and she's acts very poorly. And his homeboys are just like, oh, tough luck, man. And Dorian is furious. And so he marches, you know, to her dressing room, and he's like, what the hell was that out there? And we find out she was deliberately bad. It's not that she couldn't or anymore, like she chose not to act well. And he's like, what are you thinking? Why would you not act well? And, you know, Sybil gives the reasoning of like, now that I've known like true love with you, like, why should I, you know, spend my time manufacturing it in this artistic way on stage?
Because that's the whole point of being an actress, honey. Like, what in the world? That was, I mean, kind of like, what a, she annoyed me. So yeah. I understood a little bit of Dorian's, like, I mean, I also have done theater, and I understand what's like, it's like to have an off night, but deliberately so.
I was conflicted about Sybil, because on the one hand, it does make me think of, is she deliberately giving up, you know, an aspect of her identity in this way, her artistic ability to be with a man? Or is this genuinely, you know, I've entered a new stage of life and I don't want to act anymore?
That's a great point. She does kind of bang on about Prince Charming for a while to her mother. But that's a really good question. Maybe she's ready to move on, and that's her right. I mean, I think that's something as women, you know, that you are at 100% focused on your career or you're a mother. Like that's not, that it doesn't have to be that way. But if she wanted to just say, I'm done acting, I want to move on with my life, I guess I would like to think that if I were in her situation, I wouldn't completely like throw my stage career off the ledge to, you know, just because of that. But I don't know.
Yeah. But that's also a very modern sentiment, because, you know, you know, people who actors and actresses already, you know, were suspected of having, you know, less than stellar morals. And especially for a woman, just the idea was, even if you worked for a little bit in your youth, like if you were engaged, got married, you didn't work anymore.
Right.
Great. So there's that societal expectation. And also, I don't know, like maybe Sybil is good at it, but is Sybil doing this in part to support her family because she's an unmarried woman?
Maybe. Yeah.
I don't remember what exactly the financial situation of the Vanes were.
I know she's pretty excited to get, you know, married to, I almost said Oscar Wilde, to Dorian Gray, because I think that will give them some financial relief. So
yeah,
if I'm not confusing two books, which I might be.
Yeah. So again, from Sybil's side, I was really struck by that of, is she giving up her identity or is this a natural evolution, like that sort of thing, regardless of how yucky Dorian is being. But for Dorian, two things. First of all, I think it's he gets so angry because his manly pride has been wounded, because again, in the patriarchy, finding a beautiful woman is a very coveted prize.
Yes.
You know, getting a trophy wife is a coveted prize. And so he specifically went there wanting to show his buddies, look how well I did and look how great my fiance is. And then she falls short. And so I think part of it is the fact that she embarrassed him. And, you know, everything like that is purely about him and his macho ego. And then also it made me think about, again, the fact that, you know, I only liked you because you were an actress and because you were this great artist. And if you're not that, then you hold no interest for me anymore. And that makes me think of a question I have in my notes is, are we all just the sum of our merits? And is that fair?
I think it, you know, I think it depends. I feel like sometimes, gosh, it depends on who you're surrounding yourself with. I think it depends on, you know, the type of work you do. I would like to think not. I would like to also think, you know, I really, as much as I was annoyed with her for like throwing the play, I was also then felt bad for her when Dorian came in and was like, dude, what the hell? Why did you embarrass me in front of your friends? It's kind of like, maybe be a little supportive, like, ask. Like
even Dorian could have been like, you know, you weren't yourself. Is everything okay? It was all right about him.
Exactly. Which sometimes kind of stereotypical male. But I thought about that as well. It's like, yeah, maybe ask like something happened. And I think that's kind of hard sometimes for human beings to do. We do kind of tend to think it's, you know, all about us. But that's a great question. I would like to think some people are better than that. But then I do think that some people are just all, you know, my association with you is a reflection on me. And therefore, if you, as long as you continue to, you know, produce great art, whatever, I'm going to be associated with you. Otherwise, I'm abandoning you. I don't know. What were your thoughts on that question? That's a good question.
Well, I think it's just the idea of there's a difference between seeing someone's, like, again, artistic abilities as social capital and seeing them as points of genuine, like, relational compatibility.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're purely seeing how a person's artistic ability like benefits their social standing that, oh, look who I associate with the best artists and I go to all the, you know, best galleries and smoke pot with the most hip hipsters, you know, and shit like that. On the other hand, if you're an artist and, you know, maybe someone pretend is like, oh, I'm interested in art too. I do this and that. And you're like, oh, great. And then you realize that they lied to you, like faking their interest just to like try and fake some compatibility. And you find out there is no compatibility. Then again, like it's just how you see it as social capital or compatibility.
Right. That's a good.
Yeah. And that's all I had on the whole Sybil thing. And again, we find out that Sybil kills herself because Dorian was a dick.
poor gal. I mean, you know, we don't need to get into the poor gal. That's all I have to say about that.
And what do you think of, you know, Dorian Gray's sort of like struggles, like because he thinks of like, oh, maybe that's not the best thing. I should go and apologize and whatever, and Lord Henry always drags him back to debauchery.
Can you say that question again? I'm sorry. I'm trying to think about it.
Just thinking, like, what did you think about, you know, Dorian's struggles with himself? Because there are a few times in the book where he tries to think, oh, maybe I should try to be a little better, more like Basil, and then Lord Henry constantly is able to drag him back to his debauchery.
It made me think of Dorian as a little bit, do we know how old he is in this? I don't think we do.
Basically, it's implied that he's between 18 and 20 when this story starts, and then 18 years pass, so he's almost 40. Like, okay. He's lived almost 20 years with this painting being sucking all the bad stuff as it is.
So, you know, I guess that when he was younger, I kind of understand, like, you're just kind of young and easily influenced. Some people are. And he definitely puts a lot of stock into what Lord Henry is saying and thinking, and thinks this guy's way of life is pretty awesome. But then, you know, as he gets older, I guess he's just kind of used to that kind of lifestyle, and therefore he continues to participate in it and think nothing's wrong. Well, you know, he has that conflict, but then he goes back to just like, that's probably fine. Like, so I don't know. I just always kind of felt like he was a little weak-minded and he didn't have a lot of confidence, no matter what. He was very, I just thought that it was interesting that at the very beginning of the novel, how Lord Henry just kind of came in with these ideas and Dorian was kind of like, you know what? You're right. And then just kind of lived his life by that, with some, you know, debate, but for the most part, he just kind of rolled with it. I don't know.
Okay. And what did you think? I did not see it coming when Dorian killed Basil.
No, I did not. I did not see it. Okay. But that is also who they called Harry, right? Basil and Harry, or am I confusing somebody else? Because there was a Harry in here. And since we're reading Harry Potter, I got so confused. I was just like, no, this is not Harry Potter. But then also they said Harry was Haggard one time. And I was like,
Is that one of like the side characters in their like little posse? Like, here, let me check.
My dear Harry and my dear Basil, you both must congratulate me. So I just didn't, I wonder if he was calling Lord Henry. I don't know. I thought it was another name for
Lord Henry Harry Walton. Okay, so Harry is a, like, you know, nickname for Lord Henry.
Okay, okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah, pretty surprising, pretty jarring situation.
Yeah, so because, you know, Basil basically goes to him after not really socializing with him for many years. And he goes there and he's just like, I'm hearing the most terrible things about you. What the hell is going on? Are they true?
And he's like, no, they're not true. And then he kills him. Or, I mean, he kind of...
Well, he...
in a bad way.
Well, I think Basil demands to see the painting.
Yes. Yeah. And he's like, doesn't he? And he wants to show it. And I think he's like, I'm going to show this in a couple of months. You can part with it in a couple of months. And he's like, if you look at this painting, we are never talking again. It's pretty, he gets pretty riled up.
Yeah. And what exactly is the thing that Basil says or does that like prompts him to just stab him in the back?
I do not know. I'm sorry. I'm feverishly trying to find that scene right now.
Yeah. And yeah, so he just leaves Basil in the, again, I would like to think that if I, you know, certainly I wouldn't premeditate murder. I would like to think that if I, you know, committed murder in a sort of spontaneous way that I would just turn myself in. But, you know, Dorian Gray, like, he's like, oh crap, I've killed someone. And he deliberately goes back outside to get his butler to open the door and pretend, oh, I lost my key, like, to give himself an alibi.
So this is also like a example of how deranged his kind of thinking is.
Fact that he's so just cold-blooded that he can just kill his friend and has the know-it-all in the shock, quote-unquote shock of that, to be like, okay, I need to like think about like how to save my ass.
Right. I would like to think I would just be so appalled that I just killed somebody that I wouldn't know what to do with myself. But who the hell knows? Maybe I would be more concerned about covering my tracks. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway, but that's because we are Hufflepuffs.
Yes, exactly. That is very true. Very true.
And what I found to be more appalling than that is, so he calls upon the scientist, Alan Campbell, and basically says, I've got a body up there. I need you to completely disintegrate it, incinerate it, destroy it so that no trace of it is left. And if you don't, I'm going to blackmail you.
What a great way to treat your friends, right?
Like, and we don't know exactly what it is that Dorian blackmails him. I'm presuming that Alan was having a homosexual relationship with somebody.
Well, that's a great, okay. Yeah, because there is definitely, and we haven't really talked too much about this, but there are definitely some undertones, especially I think with Dorian and Basil, and yeah, maybe even definitely Dorian and Basil, whatever we want to call him.
Basil.
Oh, it's Basil. Okay. I don't know if I read the like Dover Thrift edition. I don't know if that was the unedited version, because I know there was an edited version and then there was an unedited version and there were kind of some more maybe, I don't know, homosexual implications through it. But it's interesting that Oscar Wilde kind of threw that in there as what were kind of going to infer from the text.
Yeah, and Alan basically does it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like, I never want to see your face again. And then Alan ends up killing himself later.
A lot of suicides going on in this book. Jeez.
Yeah, and so basically after that, we got, you know, 18 to 20 years of Dorian Gray not aging and continuing to do what he does. And it gets to a point where he goes, I don't even remember where he went. Like, he went to this brothel or tavern, and someone jokingly referred to him as Prince Charming, and Sybil's brother, James, remembers that. And it's like, oh, it was you.
Yeah, then that is not good news for Mr. Dorian Gray, because James basically said that if I ever find him,
I'll kill him.
Yeah, exactly.
And what I find interesting about this, you know, Dorian Gray is able to escape this situation because he's like, look at me. Do I look like I'm 40 to you?
Okay, so he's in the same place most of this time, right? Like, is he traveling around? I guess I forgot, because I feel like people would notice that this person, you're like, you never age. It's not like a compliment. We don't have plastic surgery back in this time. I don't know.
Yeah. So, but the one thing I was struck by is James is deceived because he's like, oh yeah, you are really young. And James is scared that he might have killed the wrong man. And that made me think about all the implications of vigilante justice with the woke mob.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, you know, just that whole phenomena of, you know, I can understand, like, people are so fed up with the system not instilling consequences for people in power and their bad behavior. So they're trying to take it upon themselves to instill some sort of consequences. But at the same time, you know, it's not as systematic. They don't have the resources. And I remember after, what was it, the Charleston riot in Virginia, where a lot of, you know, people were trying to, like, out various white supremacists who attended that riot.
Right.
And some of them were wrong, and people had to deal with all sorts of crap because people mistakenly labeled them as he was at that riot, and they're like, no, I wasn't.
Right, yeah, that's, you made me think of, I keep talking about this documentary that I watched. I just watched a documentary about Elisa Lam, who was stayed at the Cecil Hotel, basically had a manic episode and climbed into the, it's suspected, climbed into the water tower at the top of the hotel and drowned. So this artist, musician, made a song. He was at the Cecil a year before this happened, but all these internet sleuths decided that it was, he killed her. They all made this decision, and he didn't, but it basically destroyed, you know, his art and a big part of his life, because he said, you know, I will never not be attached to this. And how devastating, and what a hard way to, you know, have that stigma, and you didn't really do anything wrong. So
that just makes me think about, as much as I agree, like, there should be consequences, but at the same time, the court of public opinion should not turn into a crazy mob.
No, it definitely shouldn't. I wish we were better than that, but I don't know if we are right
now. Yeah, but, and so that's the last big thing that happens. And essentially, Dorian Gray gets disgusted with himself, and then he tries to destroy the painting and ends up killing himself in the process. And again, no explanation, no right. Grim Reaper or Death or Angel of Death coming and being like, you know, you did wrong, you know, blah, 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 I smite you or whatever.
Yeah, I wonder why that decision was made. I mean, maybe I wonder why there wasn't anything like supernatural. I mean, obviously, like, having a painting age instead of yourself is supernatural, but
that there's nothing, not a personification of that.
Yeah. I wonder why that decision was made. Someday I'll ask Oscar Wilde, maybe. I'll just be like, why'd you do this?
Yeah, do I need to get my Ouija board and crystal ball out?
Yes, please.
Yes, yeah. I own neither. I only have oracle cards and tarot cards.
I used to have a Ouija board when I was a kid, so, but not anymore. When I was watching The Exorcist and it wouldn't finish playing, I decided it needed to go.
Yeah. I just remember seeing this meme on I remember seeing this meme on Facebook. It's really old, and it's like a paper outside of a subway, and it's like, please no Ouija boards or seances, and like, you know, the caption was like, what the hell happened at Subway?
Oh. that's pretty funny. Yeah. I would like to know as well.
Yeah. So that's definitely, you know, this was written in the latter part of the 19th century, but to have like the devil or death or whoever like be personified and do making a deal and that sort of thing, that's very much more in the vein of the early Gothic literature with like the monk by Matthew Lewis.
Okay. I thought about the monk, even though I've never read it. So I'm committing a large Gothic sin.
But again, just the magic of, you know, clearly Dorian Gray has died, but is he sentient? Is he cognizant within the painting? Like, again, all these questions are unanswered. Is he at peace, or is he doomed to, like, look at the corrupt world through his painting or whatever? I don't know. Is that a legitimate form of justice for all the crap he pulled, or I don't know.
Yeah, because he basically lives a normal human life, right? He doesn't. I mean, it's not like he's, you know, 600 years old, like
Nicholas Flamel.
Yes. So, I don't know.
Yeah. So any other thoughts?
I think that this is kind of my thoughts are, I have a lot of things highlighted. I would like to sit there and contemplate some of the things I have highlighted, and honestly, it's kind of like the Lord Henry character was definitely the vessel for some of Wilde's like philosophical thoughts and things like that. Not necessarily, I don't know if he agreed with them or not, but definitely he used that character to espouse them.
Philosophical dump.
Yes. Yeah. You know, and sometimes that, like I've said, the writing is great in here, but sometimes those type of things bother me when you have a character that it's just like you the author really wanted to share some of these ideas, and you're just kind of using the character to give these really high-minded or you know, philosophical ideas. It's fine, it works. Sometimes I just think like this is Oscar Wilde doing some stuff here. So
yeah, it's overall, like, it takes a very specific type of writer to, you know, put those sort of essay, like that sort of essay prose in their writing and not, you know, stunt the narrative.
Yeah.
Because I just know I'm not the person who can do that. And so I'm like, in the book that I'm writing, like I'm doing a lot of, you know, allusions to like certain Greek mythological myth and other elements and folkloric stories all revolving around this one theme, but am I gonna sit there and go into a deep manifesto about whatever? And I'm just like, no, if I want that, I'll write an essay.
I think that I'm glad you recognize that, and you know, I think that that's a good way to approach that, where some authors don't really make that distinction, and therefore we're just kind of subjected to those sorts of things.
Yeah, like modern times, I feel like the only person who has done that well is Umberto Eco. Not even Carlos Ruiz Zafón like went that crazy in philosophy. He still kept it within a like story.
Yes, very much so. What is the Umberto? What did he write? Should I know?
The Name of the Rose.
I've never read that.
It's basically, he's a sort of monk detective where this guy died in a library and he's asked to please solve the murder, but he can't go into the crime scene, go into the library, because only certain people, high-ranking monks, can enter that library given the text they're holding.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, they created a whole miniseries based off it, and it was really good.
That sounds interesting, especially if it's what we talked about is done well.
Yeah. Anyway, but shall we move to the Gothometer?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay. So, category number one, atmosphere and setting. What did you give it?
First of all, I'd like to apologize to Oscar Wilde for, I know how I'm going to rate this. I would give it like a middle of the road 5. You know, we're in England. There's not, I don't remember there being a kind of stereotypical Gothic castle, crumbling house. So I'm going to give it a 5.
Interesting. We diverged a lot. I gave it a 9 purely for Oscar Wilde's poetry. And again, like the moon hung low in the sky, like a yellow skull. And it's like, okay, I get it.
Okay. All right. That's great justification. I definitely went more setting than I did atmosphere there, but
okay.
That's great.
Category number two, the pass.
Man, how am I going to you know, it's the thing that I'm thinking. I didn't write anything down, so I'm just going to ramble it and come up with a number. But no, I'm going to think about it. I'm going to give it a 4 for the pass, because I guess there could be an argument made that the painting is, you know, reflecting his past. But it's not like we know a lot about Dorian Gray. We don't know, you know, it's very, I'm going to give it a 4. What did you give it?
I gave it a 6 again, because the only really substantial notion of past is, again, that there's this sort of 18 to 20 year leap between Sybil dying and then her brother finally finding Dorian Gray. And so the past in that way, the past coming to catch up with him, but it wasn't a huge element. And yeah, so for that, I give it 6.
Okay, cool.
Category number 3, the supernatural.
Well, this is usually my kind of like whole, where my whole heart is with Gothic literature. And I'm a little conflicted on this one, because we talked about there isn't a personification of a supernatural. There isn't a ghost, there isn't a vampire, whatever. However, the fact that you can have like a painting that's aging and reflecting kind of your sins is pretty wild. So I'm going to give it a 7.
I'm giving it a 9 because, again, like, I don't necessarily need the supernatural element to be personified. And I think it's both an innovation, because, like, no one else has yet come up with the idea of a, you know, people have worked with mirrors, but no one ever thought of before, I think, the sort of, oh, a portrait of yourself can absorb all of your crappy behavior. But so it's in that way, it's new, but it's also timeless in, you know, the dealing with portraits all the way from Castle of Otranto. So it's both timeless and new. So all those, I'm giving it a 9.
Perfect. All right. Cool.
Category number 4, heroes, heroines, and villains.
I'm going to give this a 4, just because I'm thinking of fitting those into the categories. I mean, I guess you could argue that Dorian Gray's enemy was kind of himself a little bit, but we don't kind of have those fleshed out. I always say that when we're talking about characters. It wasn't, the characters in this story just weren't very likable, not that that makes for a high rating, but it didn't stand out to me. For so much of it was just the writing stood out to me, less the characters and the story itself. What are your thoughts?
I gave it an 8.
Man, all right, we are definitely on different thoughts on here. So
yeah, so for me, because it's not the typical like triangle, but I like it because it's like, for me, I see Basil is the good guy, Lord Henry is the scumbucket bad guy, and then we've got Dorian Gray being pulled, you know, being at conflict between these two archetypes.
That makes good sense.
So, yeah, so I think it's the sort of, like, who do we allow to, like, influence us in all of that, the good guy or the bad guy. And so, yeah, I liked that element of it. So for all that, I gave it an 8.
That makes complete sense.
Then finally, category number 5, mystery.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing because of my low score. I know I'm going to get this. I'm going to give it a 4. We find out pretty quick that, I mean, I don't know what the mystery would be. Like, that the painting is aging. I guess, why is the painting aging? I don't know. But then it's pretty easily resolved that because Dorian Gray is doing some crazy things that is making this age. But the kind of why, how that happened, I guess he spoke it into existence. I don't know. So I didn't really feel like there was a lot of mystery in this novel. But I want to know your thoughts on it.
I am giving it a 5. Again, very similar reasons. There wasn't really a mystery element of that. Again, that's not the point of it. It was supposed to be more philosophical than mysterious. Again, the only reason it is pure middle ground is because, again, the mystery surrounding the mechanism of the portrait curse.
Okay. That, yeah. Yeah, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't very mysterious. Mystery heavy. I'm doing my total here. I know it's going to be low.
Yeah. I tallied them up. You gave it 24 out of 50.
Whoa.
Yeah. Is that your lowest? I don't know. And then I did 37 out of 50.
Okay, well, we differed here a lot, I think more so than usual. But
it's funny because I gave Horrid a 50 out of 50. So taking a turn.
You can't go wrong with haunted houses.
No, you can't.
I personally see it as being gothic, but again, he just went in a really different direction with the whole portrait curse thing that isn't really, which I, in terms of being innovative, I like that a hell of a lot better than Mexican gothic's crap.
I mean, I'm going to agree with that very much. So I liked this better than Mexican gothic for sure. But I guess, you know, just I must be on a conservative gothic kick tonight or something. I don't know. The thing is, you know, I knew I wasn't going to rate this very high, not because that was my intention, just because of the thing, how I've rated things in the past. But I also felt like there's no question this does fall into the gothic literature category. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've got my Oscar Wilde book here. Shall I find a random passage?
Please do.
Okay. It's on page 130. For the wonderful beauty that had so fascinated Basil Hallward and many others beside him seemed never to leave him. Even those who had heard the most evil things against him, and from time to time strange rumors about his mode of life crept through London and became the chatter of the clubs, could not believe anything to his dishonor when they saw him. He had always the look of one who had kept himself unspotted from the world. Men who talked grossly became silent when Dorian Gray entered the room. There was something in the purity of his face that rebuked them. His mere presence seemed to recall to them the memory of the innocence that they had tarnished. They wondered how one so charming and graceful as he was could have escaped the stain of an age that was at once sordid and sensual.
So this is just basically talking about how gorgeous Dorian Gray is, I guess.
Yeah, well, this is about Dorian Gray has been living his debaucherous life for a few years by now, and his reputation is starting to catch up with him. And, you know, there are certain stories going around, but when people meet him, they're just like, oh, they can't possibly be true. Look how sweet and innocent he looks.
That's such an interesting thing, because it kind of goes along with the... I've always heard like really attractive people kind of have an easier time in life because people just kind of automatically want to make them happy, maybe. And I think sometimes we think we're above that, you know, as people. And then it's just like, I don't know.
So. Yeah. And we talk about, you know, the sort of ugliness and fat shaming in Harry Potter, where the idea is that the attractiveness is synonymous with the symbolism of this is the good character and the bad, evil characters are ugly. And that's poetic justice and everything.
Right, yeah.
I'm also seeing it a lot is I'm now 200 pages into A Clash of Kings with Song of Ice and Fire. And again, similar thing, nasty characters, with the exception of like the Lannisters, because Jaime and Cersei Lannister are supposed to be very good looking. But in some of like a lot of the lesser characters like we're dealing and meeting in the story is it's not uncommon for the not nice character to be ugly or fat.
Interesting to think about that, how they're...
Yeah. And I can't, you know, again, just the evidence as such, like, you cannot deny that there's a pretty privilege.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, for both men and women. But at the same time, I personally sometimes get frustrated when guys will say that, oh, you know, if I was, you know, good looking, men, women wouldn't see what I do as harassment. They would welcome it.
That's some bullshit.
and I really hate people who pull out that argument, because it's one thing to be deceptive, but like, you know, for me, it's like when I would go in the Middle East and there would be some really like handsome, you know, Arab men on the street, and then they would look at me and give this really like lewd smirk and maybe say something, and I'm like, oh, well, you just spoiled that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So for me, it was just like, and I don't know, it's just my personality where I, you know, I need a balance of being intellectually stimulated as well as, you know, physicality. So for me, it's like, if there's nothing substantial behind the pretty face, it's not going to carry you that far, at least with me.
I agree 100%. I also think, unlike Mr. Dorian Gray, you have confidence in that, and you're not going to be swayed by like somebody like Lord Henry's nonsense. But I think I've heard people say stuff like that too, like, oh, if the guy was hot, you wouldn't care. It's like, you don't know. You don't know. I'm sorry, a sleaze is a sleaze. Like, you know.
Yeah, and again, it depends on how, again, two-faced and duplicitous they're being about it. They're just blatantly being like whatever. But it seems that, again, in Dorian Gray's case, he's kind of doing this in a very specific social circle. And then when he comes out to another side of the social circle, like they're like, oh, no, he couldn't do that. It's not like he's doing these lecherous things like in front of them.
Right.
Which is the same thing for like men in powers. Like, you know, they don't want, like, they're not doing crazy things like in their, they don't bring the prostitute to their office. They go to the secret brothel or whatever.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. That's, you're making me think of, just like, this is very much on a smaller scale. You know, people at work will, they won't put something in an email, but they'll call you and they'll say something and it's like, they don't want, or I don't know. I have a coworker who always wants to call and talk about something because they don't want any record of it. And it's like, I'm recording this call now. So there will be
Indeed. Well, that's what you got to do nowadays.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, I just try to conduct my life. Yeah, there's a camera always on me because chances are if I want to throw a fit, there will be because our smartphones are everywhere.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true.
Alrighty then, and that concludes episode 2 of season 3 for Sublimely Gothic. Tune in next time and we will be going over The Wife Upstairs by Rachel Hawkins, which is a modern time rendition of Jane Eyre set in Birmingham, Alabama.
Beautiful, beautiful. I loved a little bit of Southern there. And would this be a Southern Gothic? I don't know if it's quite Southern Gothic. Maybe just because of the setting, we'll call it Southern.
Yeah, we will talk about that in 2 weeks' time. Catch you guys later. Bye.